upper 40s to low 50s, light and variable wind. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny and warmer highs near 55. More news is next here on People Powered KAXE.
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong.
Newly released emails raise new questions about the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and President Trump.
For Wednesday, November 12th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. You know those annoying text messages telling you to pay some toll on a road you've never driven on?
Well, Google is going after the scammers behind those texts in a lawsuit.
It allows us a legal basis on which to go to other platforms and services and ask for their assistance in taking down different components of this particular legal infrastructure.
Also, ICE expands its use of county jails as immigrant detention centers.
These facilities are places where there's terrible neglect, incredible amounts of abuse that is allowed to happen.
And tensions rise between the U.S. and Venezuela.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The House of Representatives is poised to vote on a bill to end the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Democrats railed against the measure during today's final floor debate for not further extending Affordable Care Act tax credits, which expire at the end of the year, and said Republican leaders gave lawmakers a paid vacation during the shutdown. Representative Michelle Fischbach of Minnesota defended Republicans' decision.
We were doing the work we were elected to do. And the real story here is not about the absence, it is about the commitment. And for Republicans, we never wavered. If the Democrats cared so much about working, they would not have shut the government down.
The bill would temporarily fund the government through January with longer-term funding for a few key functions like SNAP food assistance. It would also reverse the firings of workers who were let go during the shutdown. If it passes the House, the measure would still need President Trump's signature to become law. Republicans on the House Oversight Committee have released more than 20,000 new pages of documents from the estate of the late financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Stephen Fowler reports this comes after Democrats on the committee highlighted three emails that relate to President Trump.
An NPR review of the latest batch of Epstein files finds court documents, financial market outlooks, and many messages to and from Epstein about Trump. That includes one message from 2017 where Epstein wrote that, quote, "I have met some very bad people, none as bad as Trump." The Republican document dump comes as a counter to three emails released by Democrats that suggest there was more to Trump and Epstein's previous relationship than has been reported, like a 2019 message in which Epstein said that Trump, quote, "knew about the girls." Epstein died by suicide awaiting trial on charges of trafficking underage girls for sex. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
As the Trump administration is ramping up its deportation efforts, Democratic members of Congress are warning governors that immigration officials are accessing state driver's license data. NPR's Jude Joffe Block has more.
A group of 40 Democratic senators and representatives sent a letter Wednesday to 19 governors from their party, urging them to block ICE's access to their residents' driver's license data and photos to stop the Trump administration from using them from what the lawmakers call, quote, unjustified politicized actions. States share their residents' driver's license data with each other and law enforcement across the U.S. and Canada through a nonprofit called NLETS. The lawmakers say ICE and Homeland Security investigators have made hundreds of thousands of queries through NLETS in the past year. Five states had already blocked ICE's access. ICE did not return NPR's request for comment. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
U.S. stocks closed mixed today. The S&P 500 added a tenth of a percent, nearing its all-time high set a couple weeks ago. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The South Carolina Supreme Court has ruled that state lawmakers improperly gave themselves a $1,500 monthly raise. The justices said the increase counts as a salary, which can't start until after the next election in 2026. The court said the raise should have been labeled as an expense fund, not compensation, to comply with constitutional requirements. The global rate of tuberculosis has declined for the first time since the COVID pandemic disrupted health services. Both the number of people falling ill with TB and dying from it are down. But as NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports, TB remains the world's top infectious disease killer.
TB claimed over 1.2 million lives last year. That's an improvement. And Africa, in particular, has made progress, with deaths down 46% in the past decade. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus heads the World Health Organization. He says there's other good news, too.
For the first time in over a century, new effective TB vaccines for adolescents and adults are within reach.
18 TB vaccine candidates are in clinical development, but he warns that funding cuts to international aid threaten to reverse the hard-won gains. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
Actors Matthew McConaughey and Michael Caine are partnering with voice cloning company 11 Labs. Caine says the technology celebrates humanity by amplifying voices, not replacing them. McConaughey says he'll use the technology to voice his newsletter in Spanish. All right, all right, all right. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is 5:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Mesabi Community Band has a concert for veterans tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock at the Eveleth Auditorium, free and open to all. There's more ahead from All Things Considered on KAXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Today, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee released emails between Jeffrey Epstein and his confidants that suggest that President Trump may have known about Epstein's sex abuse operations. In one email, Epstein writes that Trump, quote, spent hours at my house with one of Epstein's victims. In another, he writes that Trump, quote, knew about the girls. And a third, a writer advises Epstein that he can use his history with Trump as a, quote, valuable PR and political currency should he ever need to. Democrats are trying to force the Department of Justice to release more information from its investigation of Epstein and accuses the White House of a cover-up. In response to today's release, the White House said that these were, quote, selectively leaked emails to, quote, create a fake narrative. And Republicans on the Oversight Committee released more than 20,000 pages of documents from the Epstein case, from which these three emails came. Let's hear more from Representative Robert Garcia of California. He is the ranking Democratic member of the House Oversight Committee. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
Let's start with this. We have long known now that the future president and Jeffrey Epstein were friendly before they had a falling out around 2004, which was well before Trump ran for president. What did we learn that was new here? Did this bring any new information?
I think that the emails today show clearly that there is a relationship between Donald Trump and Epstein. As far as what Donald Trump knew, what he participated in, I think are real questions. And I think the thing on everyone's mind, certainly those of us on the committee, is why the cover-up? Why won't the White House release the full Epstein files? You have an email today essentially saying that Donald Trump may have spent hours with one of the victims. You have, as you said, another email that talks about Donald Trump possibly knowing what was happening with these girls. And I think this is really disturbing stuff. We want justice for these women and these survivors. We know that many were abused when they were underage. Mm-hmm. And powerful men were involved. And our whole goal here is to get to the truth. And we are imploring the Department of Justice to release the files.
But again, we've all been blanketed with the pictures of these two men together. We saw a lot of reporting earlier this year of these alleged birthday notes that Trump was writing to Epstein. What new information did you learn from these emails?
Well, I think part of it is the president admitting that there was a real relationship here between him and Epstein. And I think that is what today's emails actually also show.
First, well, these are all other people talking about Trump. Trump does
absolutely not
appear himself.
That's right. This is Jeffrey Epstein's emails. And there's 23,000 documents here, of course. And so what's important is when you spend the entire campaign saying you're going to release the Epstein files, when we know that Jeffrey Epstein has said that Donald Trump was his best friend for 10 years, the birthday note you just referenced, Donald Trump, as a reminder, said it didn't exist until we actually produced it with his own signature. And so Trump has a record of lying about this, and he has a record of saying that he wants its release, and now they're refusing to do so. I think it's important to note that every single piece of evidence we want to release to the public. This is about transparency, it's about oversight, and it's about getting justice for the victims.
Curious how you're approaching this. This is a case laden with conspiracy theories. These are emails, many of whom are coming from not especially trustworthy people. How are you verifying this information that you're looking at?
Look, I think the important thing is that people absorb and read the documents for themselves and make their own judgments. I think for us, clearly anything that is a correspondence from Jeffrey Epstein, whether it's to Ghislaine Maxwell, which we saw today in one of those emails, or others, is significant. And what we're trying to say right now at this moment is the only way to get the full picture of what happened is for the DOJ to follow the subpoena sent by the Oversight Committee and to hand over all of the documents. Well, there are an enormous amount of documents, photographs, possibly videos, that the public has a right to know what actually happened. We know, for example, that back when the Epstein case was being developed and prosecuted, there were multiple men that were going to be named as co-conspirators in this, and that was all essentially washed aside by, at the time, Alex Acosta, who then becomes, of course, Trump's labor secretary. So there's a lot of questions here.
I want to make sure we get to a few more points here. This is also a notable day in that you're about to gain another Democratic member of the House who will side the discharge position and petition and force a vote possibly on the House floor to release the files. We know the White House is pressuring the four Republicans who have signed on that to that petition to pull their names. Are you in communication with any of these Republican representatives who have been having meetings at the White House today?
Look, I've been talking to many Republicans. There's no question that if we hold and they hold, this will pass the House and there will be numerous Republicans that will vote yes. They understand that this is important to their constituency. The Epstein files and its release is very bipartisan when you ask the American public.
And what's and important, again, the question, what especially is important, because again, this is something that's been playing out for more than a decade now. This is somebody who's been long dead but continues to make news. Why is this the priority for you given all of the other issues the federal government is facing right now?
Well, look, I think there's a lot of important things. We've got to focus on health care. We've got to focus on lowering costs. This goes straight to the corruption of this administration. And Donald Trump spent his campaign talking about this. And if you were going to lean in so hard on a campaign promise and then essentially go back on it, we have to ask why. And in meeting all of these women and these victims and survivors, they want justice. I've talked to many of them personally, one-on-one, and they deserve justice and they deserve the truth.
How do you balance? But
let me say one more thing, 'cause I think it's really important. When you have powerful men, and I don't care what party they're in, what their job is. When you have powerful men abuse, rape, and traffic women, and yet you don't bring justice to those women, what are we saying to American kids, to girls, to women across this country, that the most powerful men can get away with this? And that has to also drive our investigation.
Congressman, we got about 30 seconds left, but how do you balance transparency and protecting these victims who have been abused so many times at this point forward with the release of thousands of pages of information?
What's most important at the end of the day is we've got to protect the victims, and so we're doing that. We're redacting names. We've made that promise, and everything else we're going to get out to the public.
That is Congressman Robert Garcia of California, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
As the Trump administration arrests and detains record numbers of immigrants who lack full legal status, more of them are passing through county jails. Many local governments have contracts with ICE to hold people until their deportation proceedings. And one detention center in Kansas underscores what advocates say are dangerous conditions happening more often as ICE expands its use of county jails. Zane Irwin of the Kansas News Service reports.
The Chase County Detention Center is in Cottonwood Falls, Kansas, 2 hours away from the nearest immigration court. Since 2008, the county's had an agreement with the federal government to hold ICE detainees. Jose, who overstayed a visa but had applied for deportation protections, spent many weeks at the facility this year. He asked that only his first name be used for fear of retaliation. Jose says the experience was unbearable because he has gout, a form of arthritis that causes bouts of searing joint pain.
Those are really horrible days for me. I can't even walk to the bathroom. You know, like being in jail with that pain is just like, what's going to happen to me?
In the Chase County Jail, Jose says he was often forced to sleep on the ground, which made the pain worse. And when he asked for medical help,
I talked to the nurse and I told her, and she said, oh yeah, in 5 days, if it doesn't go away, I will take you to the hospital. 10 days passed by, 11, like 15 days passed by, it never happened.
Ginevra Alberti is an immigration attorney at a firm that's represented several Chase County detainees. Her clients have complained about being crammed with three people in cells designed for two, widespread skin irritation caused by jail-provided shampoo and soap, and persistent medical neglect. She says one client, named Luis Diaz Inestroza, spent weeks at the facility without receiving treatment for a tooth infection. He chose to return to Honduras without seeing his immigration case through.
He could not stomach the idea of staying and fighting his case, even though his whole family is here, because he was in such severe pain.
Chase County Sheriff Jacob Welsh runs the facility. He said in a statement, the jail gets positive feedback from inspections, which are performed by ICE contractors and the Department of Homeland Security. An inspection last March found no serious health and safety violations in Chase County. ICE detention statistics show the agencies used over 170 facilities in the past year to hold immigrants awaiting deportation proceedings. At least a third of those are county jails. In those local facilities, migrants without legal status often outnumber people who've been arrested locally. And Eunice Cho at the American Civil Liberties Union says the rush to detain and deport immigrants has led to overcrowding and dangerous conditions in some detention centers used by ICE.
These facilities are places where there's terrible neglect, incredible amounts of abuse that is allowed to happen, where people die because of the fact that they are not receiving proper medical care.
ICE has reported at least 20 detainee deaths so far this year, the most since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Border czar Tom Homan defended the agency's practices in June when a reporter asked him about a detainee death in Florida.
I mean, people die in ICE custody. People die in county jail. People die in state prisons. I mean, people can argue with me all they want, but the facts are the facts that we have the highest detention standards in the industry.
Some detainees, like Jose, disagree. And he says rough conditions weren't the only reason that people thought about leaving the U.S. He says once or twice per week, an immigration officer would visit Chase County, promising detainees $1,000 if they chose to self-deport.
It makes you feel that you want to give up everything that you've done in this country. They don't care. They don't care.
Jose was able to leave Chase County without being deported, for now. But he seriously considered signing on the dotted line just to get out, even if it meant abandoning his work and his family. For NPR News, I'm Zane Irwin in Kansas City, Missouri.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear the set list in there. And at 7 o'clock, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information at northhomes.org. Our weather for tonight, mostly clear with lows in the mid-20s. Good chance once again for the Aurora Borealis. And for tomorrow, sunny, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, light and variable wind. For Friday, mostly sunny and a bit warmer, highs near 55. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork tomorrow evening. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30. The Crossing Arts Alliance in Brainerd has an opening reception for this year's Kringle Market this Friday, November 14th from 5 to 7 by unique crafts, gifts, and cards made by dozens of local artists. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. It has been a month since the ceasefire in Gaza went into effect. President Trump claimed the deal he put forward ended the war, but Gaza's health ministry says in the ceasefire, 245 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire, and the Israeli military says three soldiers were killed by militants. Despite the violence, both sides say they are committed to the ceasefire. To give us the latest, we are joined by NPR international correspondent Aya Batrawi in Dubai. Hey there.
Hi, Scott.
So let's just get an update here. Hamas has released all the living Israeli hostages it was holding. Why hasn't the ceasefire moved on to the next phase?
Yeah, the living hostages were released in an exchange for a number of detained Palestinians right away in the first 72 hours. But Israel is insisting on the return of the remains of all the deceased hostages in Gaza as well. Hamas has returned the remains of 24 of those hostages, but four bodies have yet to be returned, and we just don't know whether Hamas can reach them under the rubble or even knows where they are. And as part of the deal, Israel has also returned 315 bodies of Palestinians it was holding to Gaza. But less than a third of those, Scott, have actually been identified due to a lack of DNA testing in Gaza after the war.
I mean, I read the stats that I began this report with, and I wonder, is it fair to call this a truce if people are still being killed?
The number of Palestinians killed this past month in the ceasefire are actually a fraction of the more than 69,000 deaths recorded by Gaza's health ministry during the war. So some of those people were killed trying to check on their homes in Gaza in areas they thought were in under Israeli control. But others, many of them civilians, were killed in Israeli airstrikes that Israel says was in retaliation against Hamas for attacks on its soldiers in southern Gaza.
A month in, what is the mood like in Gaza?
People we've talked to say this feels like a pause to them rather than a recovery. And that's in large part because Israel continues to impede aid getting into Gaza. Although Israel's military tells us hundreds of trucks of aid are entering daily now when we inquired, and this was required in Trump's plan, UN agencies say fruits, vegetables, eggs, and meat remain rare. The UN says actually a fifth of Gaza's households still say that they are only eating one meal a day. And so right now you can see Israeli chocolates and instant coffee in the markets in Gaza, but basic medicines, for example, aren't available. And we're also seeing reports that the U.S. now is taking a bigger role in overseeing aid. And so that could be why today, for example, Israel said it would open a vital crossing into northern Gaza, where, if you recall, a famine was declared over the summer.
And even though many politicians are talking about this as a lasting peace, this is a reminder, this is just step one in a multi-phase complicated process. What needs to happen for this deal to move on to the second phase?
So this is where the plan will really succeed or falter. It calls for Hamas to disarm, then for Israel to withdraw to the periphery, and then for reconstruction of Gaza to begin. But you need Egyptian forces and others to be in Gaza to oversee that. So the U.S. right now has a draft resolution before the U.N. Security Council to give that International Stabilization Force a clear mandate. But it's unclear which countries will actually send troops and when. And while all this is dragging on, there's an idea floated by Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, that reconstruction could get started in Israeli-occupied East Gaza, and that local Palestinian clans opposed to Hamas, who are openly armed by Israel, would also be in control of those areas. And so this idea is being called two Gazas, the western side that's under Hamas and the eastern side occupied by Israel. But it's very hard to imagine Palestinians voluntarily moving to an area occupied by Israel, even if there are homes being built there, or this idea getting broad Arab support. And so the risk, Scott, is that the longer that it takes for that international stabilization force to be deployed, the more unstable Gaza becomes and the more entrenched its division.
That is NPR's Aya Batrawi in Dubai. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Former Top Chef host Padma Lakshmi has always seen food as a vehicle for learning, not just about cooking, but learning about people and about life in general. In her new book, Padma's All American, she offers stories and recipes from people she's encountered all across the U.S.
There's sacredness to everything if it's done with care and intention. We're such a fast culture now. We just breeze over everything to get to the next thing. And I hope that this book inspires people not only to slow down and cook, but also to get to know their neighbors.
Lakshmi talked to Wildcard host Rachel Martin about her early experiences learning life lessons through food.
Where would you go when you wanted to feel safe as a kid?
My grandmother's house. Mm. Every summer, I was a latchkey kid in New York. My mom was a single mother. And every summer, right after school let out in June, I was sent back to India for 3 months. And I loved it there. My grandparents were retired. We lived in a seaside town in Chennai. And I remember being very happy, not really having a lot of toys, but playing with these wooden dishes, which in Tamil are called choppu, and, you know, just play cooking. It's really interesting. If I look back now, it's no surprise.
Right. Started early.
Yeah. And, you know, she used cooking as a way to teach me about life and saying, you know, everything, just like life, everything has its time. Everything has its moment. You know, there's a time for every vegetable to get dropped into the curry. And, you know, I learned so much at my grandmother's elbow. She just had the touch. In Tamil, there's a saying, avaloda kaiko ra vasna irka, which means her hand has an aroma. So that everything you touch or that person touches becomes something that smells good, is aromatic and delicious. And you know, my
like
grandmother
the Midas
worked
touch
very
except
hard.
For flavor. I love that.
Yes, exactly.
Do you still have her in your life?
I don't. You know, she died during COVID, unfortunately.
Oh,
and I was able to somehow swing a visa and run to her bedside at the hospital. And she died 8 hours after I saw her.
Oh.
So she waited for me. And, you know, she lived a really long, beautiful life. She was 89 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She came from a sibling, a family of 16 siblings.
Oh, Lord.
And she was one of the oldest, so she took care of a lot of people over the course of her life. And I think it taught her patience. My grandmother was not a cuddly person. She was a nice person and a kind person, but she wasn't very warm or cuddly. But I really loved her, you know, and she was very matter of fact. And I remember asking her once, you know, Patti, are you happy? And she would answer by saying, you know, for her, happiness wasn't a thing to be. It was a verb, you know, that if she had finished all the things on her mental list for that day, when she went to sleep happy because she had gotten done everything. And she's just a very practical, pragmatic woman. And I think I learned so much from her that had nothing to do with cooking, but also everything to do with cooking.
And you can watch a longer conversation with Padma Lakshmi by following NPR's Wildcard on YouTube. Her new book, Padma's All American, is out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, local news from our region, the Up North Report. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Mostly clear tonight, lows in the mid-20s, and tomorrow sunny, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, light and variable wind. For Friday, mostly sunny, highs near 55.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. On Veterans Day, Governor Tim Walz issued an executive order creating a statewide veteran food pantry network. The Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs is tasked with coordinating the effort to address food insecurity for veterans, service members, and their families. The order allows the agency to accept non-perishable food donations and works with other organizations and agencies on logistics like food sourcing, warehousing, and distribution. According to the state, thousands of Minnesota's 280,000 veterans depend on federal food programs like SNAP. Existing barriers and the impact of the government shutdown showed it needed a new approach to veteran food insecurity. In a social media post announcing the move, Walz says, quote, "Regardless of what happens at the federal level, Minnesota remains committed to providing for those who protect our freedom." The nearly 300 nurses who work at St. Joseph's Medical Center in Brainerd have a tentative agreement on a new three-year contract. Essentia Health characterized the month-and-a-half-long negotiating process as efficient and productive. The organization says the new contract addresses union concerns around overstaffing. The agreement is tentative until the nurses' union votes to ratify it. The Minnesota Nurses Association had not returned a request for comment as of Wednesday evening. Grand Rapids is reimagining one of its largest parks. The 160-acre American Legion Memorial Park includes the high school and its athletic fields, the Rife Center, and Yanmar Arena, plus an expansive trail system. Funded by a Blandin Foundation grant, the city is crafting a master plan to improve the park's facilities, maximize potential use of the space, and capitalize on the park's economic benefits. Public input will help determine what that looks like. A survey on the project's website is open through the end of the month. It suggests possible facilities that could be added to Legion Park, including a splash pad, indoor playground, or outdoor exercise equipment. The city plans to host a focus group this winter, with planning and recommendations coming by spring and a finalized plan ready by next summer. Construction season is nearing its end, but Paul Bunyan Communications says its broadband expansion projects in Itasca and St. Louis counties are still on track. Services are now available in Coleraine and Bearville, Sandy, Pike, Warre, and French townships. Service is expected in Elango, Angora, and Owens townships by the end of November, Bovee by mid-December, Balkan Township by the end of December, and Great Scott Township by the end of January. Kitson County Central head football coach Corey Whaling was on the road Wednesday afternoon. It's about a six-hour drive for the Bearcats from the northwestern corner of Minnesota to U.S. Bank Stadium, where they'll play Hillcrest Lutheran Academy of Fergus Falls in the nine-player semifinals on Thursday.
Just, you know, dealing with the distractions and putting all that stuff out of your head where we can be focused on the game and focused on what your assignments are. And it's a long haul, but in a way it's kind of adds to the excitement to it.
The Bearcats are one of four Northland teams preparing for tough matchups this week. Defending nine-player champion Fertile Beltrami also plays Thursday. Grand Rapids plays in the 4A semifinals on Friday, and Menominwaben will represent the region in 1A on Saturday. The Thunderbirds in particular have a tall task. They play the three-time defending champions who haven't lost a game since 2022. Here's head coach John Clark Jr.
You know, we want to make sure that we execute at our highest level and give ourselves a chance. You know, one thing when you play teams as good as Minnesota, you can't beat yourselves. You have to make them make plays.
For Grand Rapids, the trip to the bank feels like hard work paying off. Head coach Greg Spahn says the Thunderhawks were close to breaking through last year, but got bit by the injury bug and finished 6-4. This year, they've stayed healthy, and lots of guys are playing at a high level. Their work this offseason has also played a role.
From our leadership council and class that we run to you know, the way that we lift and run and all that stuff. And I think you combined all those things and you end up with a pretty special season.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. From Arm, on the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Renee Haas talks to Minister Ashwini Vaishnav of India about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Scammers and spammers. We have all dealt with them. You get a text from a number that you don't recognize, and you're told that you haven't paid some toll on some road that you've never driven on, or that there's some package waiting for you, and all you need to do is to click here. Well, now Google is going on the offensive. NPR tech correspondent John Ruwitch joins us now with more. And just a note before we get started, Google is a financial supporter of NPR. Hi, John.
Hey there, Elsa.
Hey, okay, so what is Google doing with these annoying scammers?
Yeah, Google launched a lawsuit in the Southern District of New York today against a group that it calls Lighthouse. The suit describes this as a very well-organized criminal organization based in China that has basically an off-the-shelf suite of software to help cyber criminals pull off phishing scams. And we've all been there, right? You get that text. There's the link. If you click on that link, you're taken to a fake website, and that's where a lot of people get tricked into giving up personal information or credit card numbers. Google's allegation is that this criminal network's software helps these cyber criminals hook victims by spoofing legitimate websites like the West Virginia DMV, for instance, or New York's Easy Pass for highway tolls.
Okay, but if Google is suing, it must be claiming harm. So how is Google harmed in all of this?
Yes. Yeah, well, Google says a lot of those fake websites and even the templates for creating the fake websites, those templates are made by Lighthouse, it says, they use Google's logo. So think Google Pay or that sign-in button. And screenshots in the court document actually showed that not only were Google's logos there, but logos of other big tech companies, payment companies, credit cards. Google says this makes the fake websites look more legit, but they undermine trust in the company. And so that's where the damage is. And the stakes are high. Google says millions of people in over 120 countries have been victims of scams enabled by Lighthouse. Millions of dollars are being swindled every year.
But if these defendants are in China, how does the U.S. court system reach them over there?
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah. I mean, that's a tough piece. Making it even harder, Elsa, is the fact that at this stage, Google doesn't even know who these people are. In the court filing, they're referred to as Does 1 through 25. That's Doe as in John or Jane Doe.
Right.
Google named some of the social media handles that they were allegedly using. I reached out to them through the Telegram messaging app. Uh-huh. Most didn't reply. One of them did reply. He denied knowledge of this or any involvement in the Lighthouse Enterprise. But here's the thing. Getting them into court right now is not the point. Here's Google's general counsel, Halima Delaine Prado.
The goal is deterrence.
So she says what Google wants is a ruling from the court, an injunction that says Lighthouse's activity is illegal. And then that's something that Google can then work with.
It allows us a legal basis on which to go to other platforms and services and ask for their assistance in taking down different components of this particular illegal infrastructure.
Right, so they could potentially team up with, say, messaging platforms or web hosting companies or others who may or may not know that they're facilitating Lighthouse's transnational operation to start taking it apart.
But why do you think Google would want to take up this fight now in particular?
Yeah, you know, scams are on the rise. U.S. government agencies and a lot of others have issued reports and warnings that phishing attacks have been surging. Delay and Prado says they're doing this because, you know, these scams affect Google and its customers. And remember, Google's gigantic, right? It's got a giant brand to protect. It's global. And at the end of the day, it has the resources to step up and do this.
That is NPR's John Ruwitch in Silicon Valley. Thank you, John.
You bet.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
The nation's largest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald R. Ford, has been making its way around the globe and has now entered the waters under the control of U.S. Southern Command. That is the military command focused on Central and South America. The move highlights the growing tensions with Venezuela as the U.S. ramps up its presence in the region. Now, this all follows several rounds of deadly military strikes against boats and ships carrying people the Trump administration has called narco-terrorists. Venezuelan authorities say the buildup is a pretext for regime change in their country. For more, we're going to go to NPR's Carrie Kahn in neighboring Ecuador. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, Scott.
Do we know where the aircraft carrier Gerald Ford is right now?
Not exactly. In a statement, the Pentagon said the huge ship is now under the jurisdiction of Southern Command, which encompasses a very large region near Latin America. But waiting for it is already a large U.S. military presence in the Caribbean. To date, those assets have struck 19 small boats suspected of running drugs and killed at least 76 people the U.S. says were all alleged drug traffickers. Critics have been questioning the legality of these strikes and saying even before the Gerald R. Ford arrives, look, there's already too much firepower in the region if all you're doing is interdicting these alleged small-time drug runners. And they say it's looking more like that show of force is about unseating Venezuela's leader, Nicolas Maduro, a longtime target of the U.S.
What has Maduro said in response to all of this?
He's made a big show of announcing what he's called this national plan to defend the homeland, including calling up troops or forces. His defense minister puts that force at 200,000. It's unclear if that's even possible. Vladimir Padrino, the defense minister, has been saying Venezuela does not want war.
Pero si llegan a tocar a Venezuela, bueno, aquí lo van a conseguir.
But he says if the U.S. does actually attack Venezuela, they are going to have to go through a very determined people ready to defend until the death. He's been on repeat on state TV. He's handing out like weapons, moving what looks like very outdated military hardware around, and sounding alarms since last night.
What has the response been throughout the region as this U.S. military buildup has continued?
Neighboring Colombia has been the loudest critic of the U.S. President Gustavo Petro there, a fellow leftist, has been sanctioned by the Trump administration. Trump has called him an illegal drug dealer. Petro says Colombia will no longer give drug intelligence to the U.S. And that's huge because for decades, Colombia has been the U.S.'s staunchest ally in the so-called war on drugs. The U.S. has spent billions cooperating with Colombia. A former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, James Story, tells me without Colombian cooperation, the U.S. is at a severe disadvantage.
Because it's the source country of most of the cocaine that flows north, as well as a good amount of the heroin. And if we're blind to what's happening on the ground in Colombia, we're not going to be as successful in stopping those drugs from reaching the United States.
Britain says it's no longer going to cooperate on some intelligence sharing with the U.S. because of the U.S. boat strikes. An official who was not authorized to speak publicly told NPR that overall intelligence sharing remains strong, but certain U.S. requests are being denied because they do not align with British foreign policy. And also France's foreign minister condemned the attacks. He's calling it a violation of international law. And both of those countries, of course, have territories in the Caribbean.
That is NPR's Carrie Kahn joining us from Ecuador. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. When California voted to legalize marijuana, it did so in exchange for some of that tax revenue going towards youth groups. Governor Gavin Newsom recently lowered the state's cannabis tax from 19 to 15%. It will mean relief for an industry that some claim is already overregulated. But the organizations and kids who rely on those tax dollars are now feeling betrayed. KQED's April Domboski has more.
At Canacraft in Santa Rosa, the manufacturing floor is a scene out of Willy Wonka's weed factory. An industrial machine originally made for weighing M&Ms is used here to parse watermelon pot gummies into 3-ounce portions. Tiffany Devitt heads up regulatory affairs. She says buying machines like this have helped with labor costs, and they needed that help.
If we weren't able to do that, our razor-thin margins would not be tenable.
Devitt says operating in California's legal pot market is like walking an economic tightrope. Labor laws are strict. Testing and compliance is expensive. Taxes are levied at almost every stop in the supply chain. First, the farmers.
It's a local cannabis cultivation tax.
Then the gummy makers.
Manufacturing tax.
The distributors.
What they call a road tax.
And finally, the dispensaries.
Local cannabis retail tax.
Then the state tax kicks in at the end when you buy it.
End of the day, you end up with a total tax burden of around 40%.
The result, Devitt says, is that legal products cost 3 times more than illegal ones.
Consumers are price sensitive, right? You raise the prices, they go to the illicit market, and they're like, oh, this works for me. It's a lot cheaper. Buy it from Uncle Joe.
This is why state lawmakers lowered the state cannabis tax from 19 to 15%, hoping the legal market can regain enough of a foothold to compete with the black market. But that breaks a promise made to Californians. Voters agreed to legalize marijuana in exchange for investing some of that tax revenue in youth drug prevention and other programs. The tax cut will strip those groups of $180 million a year.
It's taking directly from our youth.
Leticia Aguilar runs Native Sister Circle, an after-school program for Indigenous girls in Sacramento. It gets 80% of its funding from the pot tax. Angelina Hinojosa joined the group several years ago, in part to get away from all the weed at her high school.
Everybody smoked. Even people that played sports smoked. And if you're already a marginalized group, it's so easy for you to get sucked into that crowd. It's so easy.
Learning how to sew traditional skirts and weave baskets gave her a new sense of identity outside of drugs.
Therapy didn't help me. Counseling didn't help me. For me, when I basket weave, everything goes away. I feel like that's prevention.
But not everyone thinks the tax cut will hurt youth groups. Some think the groups might actually do better. Here's UC Davis economist Robin Goldstein.
It sort of sounds intuitively like if we tax it at 15% versus 10%, of course we're going to collect more tax revenue, right? But not necessarily.
Lower taxes could actually drive more sales in the legal market and push tax revenues higher. The thing is, no one knows exactly what the magic number is.
It's a judgment call.
Montana bet on 20%. Maine and Minnesota, 10%. California lawmakers settled in the middle at 15. They hope cutting the state cannabis tax will yield more money for youth groups in the long run. For NPR News, I'm April Domboski in Sacramento.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 5:48. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. We'll also sample our album of the week and hear the set list. Coming up at 7, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. And at 10 o'clock, Headwaters with Kari Headland. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji, providing full-service interior painting in residential locations throughout northern Minnesota, offering custom kitchen cabinet refinishing, as well as one-room or whole-house repainting. More information at borealbrushworkspainting.com. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the mid-20s. Forecast is good once again for Northern Lights in the area. For tomorrow, sunny with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, light and variable wind. Lows tomorrow night in the low 30s. And looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny, highs near 55. Support comes from the Third Coast Chamber Collective, presenting chamber music up north, featuring an internationally renowned accordion and violin ensemble from Poland at Co-House, November 20th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at thirdcoastchambercollective.com. Programming is also supported in part by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation to celebrate the honorees of the 2025 Bush Prize Minnesota, Foster Advocates, and Dakota Wikohan. More information online at spmfc.org. Happy Dancing Turtle has a holiday decor swap this Saturday, 9 to noon, at their office in Pine River. Items may include lights, tablecloths, gift wrap, and other decorations. If you would like to drop off items, they will be accepted from noon to 6 tomorrow or 8 to noon on Friday. You do not need to donate items in order to take items. More news is next on KAXE.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The new novel, Some Bright Nowhere, focuses tightly on a long, mostly happily married couple. Elliot and Claire have raised two children, built two careers. By the time we meet them, Claire is very sick. The book opens with her final visit to her oncologist and with her making a brutal request of her husband. Ann Packer is the author. She's with us now from New York. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Describe the request.
So Elliot's been taking care of Claire since her diagnosis 8 years before the book starts. And she says that she would like her closest women friends to be in the house with her, taking care of her during her final days and weeks, and for Elliot to move out.
This struck me as so incredibly cruel. Is it? Is that the way you meant it?
I didn't mean it as cruel, no. I meant it as a reflection of her deep feelings in a very scary and sad moment in her life. And in fact, when she makes the request, she does it kind of whimsically. She went through women-only seeing a friend toward death herself as one of the friends in the circle, and she found it very moving. And she wants it for herself, and she's conveying her, well, her dying wish, really.
Claire, as we noted, she's dying. Elliot, on some level, struck me as a man coming back to life, like trying to figure out, who was I? What's left of that man? Because cancer has consumed their life for years now. He's been a caregiver to Claire, and that's been it.
Right. And I think in a way, you could look at her request as entirely unconscious on her part, but aimed at helping Elliot find himself in these final days before he's going to actually be on his own and really need himself.
Is she still trying to figure out something?
I think she is, but again, kind of unconsciously. She's just feeling what does she want? What would be the way to go through this unthinkable process of dying? It turns out late in the book that she had other reasons for wanting him gone, but that's something that the two of them have to kind of work their way towards together and apart.
One of the things Elliot struggles with most is the uncertainty of not knowing how much time they have left together. He keeps calling the hospice nurses and bugging them for answers, like, do we have days? Do we have weeks? Do we have months? And their answer is the honest one, we don't know. That felt so human to me.
I think it's so hard. In a death from an illness like cancer, you know it's coming. And you can't control that at all. The idea that you can get a bead on how long you have is very powerful. In a way, it gives you something that you can't exactly control, but that you can control your reaction to it. So for him, if they tell him 6 months, then that allows him to sort of construct the near future in one way.
Yeah, like how many more steak dinners do we have here?
Right.
Like, do I buy the fresh corn or not?
Exactly. And if they say, you know, it's probably about 7 days, well, then you're thinking completely differently. And he just wishes he could know. And he's very frustrated when not only do they not know, but they keep somewhat casually revising the estimate based.
She's always got 6 months to live.
Three to six months.
It's not funny, but it's kind of, you're like, what are we supposed to do with that?
Exactly. Is it 1 to 3 months or 3 to 6 months? And at what point in either of those windows is it really going to be?
I have lost a loved one to cancer. Many people listening, I'm sure, have. It's incredibly depressing. As you wrote this, you let us sit with the sadness of it. Did you also manage to find something beautiful, hopeful along the way?
I think so. To me, there's something beautiful in the intimacy and the truth of what this couple and their children and friends get to at the end of the book. It's a journey everybody's going to go on one way or another. And in a way, what I hope happened to them in the book was that in some way, the prospect became more real and less terrifying.
Say more about that.
Well, I think that as you walk out of the oncologist's office for the last time with a prescription for hospice,
right,
you're basically being told, this is it, 6 months. It's unfathomable at that point. But as you go through the days, the weeks, possibly the months, you discover that in a way, dying is more of the same until it isn't. And I wanted to sort of pause at the point in the book where I think one of the hospice workers says to Elliot, it's usually around now that people begin to understand what it's like when someone's actively dying.
Ann Packer, this is your first novel in a decade, is that right?
It is, yes. It is.
I will confess that I was digging around and I found an essay you wrote, this is for the New York Times, you wrote it a decade ago, 2015, and it was about what writers do between books.
Right.
I will quote you. Quote, novelists do all kinds of things as they wait for their books to be published, from imagining unforeseen commercial success to imagining unforeseen commercial success.
You got me.
And then you add, just kidding, we also update our websites.
And that just shows you how long ago it was, because of course now it's our Instagram.
Yeah,
instead of our websites.
Exactly. So what took you so long?
You know, I was working on a different book for a lot of that time. I had a book that I started shortly after the last one came out, and it was very complicated structurally. And I wrote it and wrote it and wrote it and wrote it, and I just couldn't get it to the right place. And it was very depressing. And it actually caused me to have a hard time finding something different to work on. Then I thought about working on this, and to my, you know, surprise and delight, I got a first draft done in 4 months.
Wow.
Which is unheard of for me. So I got through the long process of working on something that didn't work, only to find that there was still a way to get something done that did work.
Wow. Speaking of things that are both depressing and actually really hopeful.
You're getting a sense of my psyche here.
Ann Packer, her latest novel is Some Bright Nowhere. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation,
recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. This is NPR.
It is a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may also find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock tonight, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River. Support comes from Bridget's Pub in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish